Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Through most of her career, Harvard University political scientist and humanities scholar Danielle Allen has examined the concepts of justice and citizenship through history, from how ancient Athens punished wrongdoers in their society to the notions of citizenship in a desegregated America, to how the Declaration of Independence speaks to our 21st century understanding of equality. Her latest book, though, is a deeply personal story, all too common in American culture. How a family member's life was cut short through criminal incarceration and the culture of violence where he lived. Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A., tells the story of Allen's cousin, who after a move to inner city Los Angeles quickly became involved in gangs and within 18 months was arrested after a botched carjacking and then immediately confessed to several other armed robberies. At the age of 15, he was facing either life without parole or a plea bargain. After 10 years in prison, he was paroled, but returned to his first love, Bree, a transgendered woman he'd met in prison, who ultimately murdered him. Danielle Allen is the Conant University Professor at Harvard and Director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. She'll be a guest of Booksmart Tulsa and the Oklahoma Policy Institute tonight at 7 o'clock at the TCC Center for Creativity, and she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Danielle Allen, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me. Glad to be here.
This book, Cuz, about the story of your cousin, Michael, it sounds like it took a long time to write and a long time to process his story. What went into the decision to go ahead and write a book about him?
Well, a long time to process. So my cousin was first arrested when he was 15 in 1995 for an attempted carjacking, and he was sentenced to 13 years, roughly, and served 11. So I was the cousin on duty when he got out in 2006. And then 3 years after his first release, he was killed by somebody he'd met in prison. So that was in 2009. And the fact is my family just sort of shut down when he died. We didn't talk at all about what had happened or why. And it wasn't until, many years later, basically, 2016, I guess, that I took it on myself to try to tell Michael's story. My reason for doing that is a slightly strange reason. I was invited to give a series of public lectures at Harvard, very distinguished academic lectures, the Du Bois lectures. W.E.B. Du Bois was an early 20th century sociologist. The job of the lectures is to say something about the state of affairs for African Americans in the country. And I kept deferring the dates of the lectures. And I realized, and I kept also giving them these really abstract titles, just, political equality in the 21st century or race and justice in the African-American situation. But I kept deferring. And finally, the person who invited me, Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr., said, look, you can't keep putting this off, kid. You're going to have to give these lectures. And I realized I had been deferring because I couldn't pretend to comment on the state of affairs for African-Americans
in an abstract manner when you have this very personal story.
Exactly. I couldn't pretend, that it didn't matter to me. And I couldn't do it without understanding my cousin's story. So I gave these three formal public lectures in front of these big audiences in an academic lecture theater that were basically working through what had happened to my cousin. The strangest lectures Harvard has ever seen. Probably I was crying through every single one of them. But doing that forced me to get my family members to sit down and talk and work together to figure out what had happened.
I can't remember if it was a reviewer or this is something you actually wrote. It said, any African-American person of distinction probably has a close family member, like a cousin, first cousin, or nephew, niece, some relation that is totally enmeshed in our criminal justice system.
It's true. I mean, the magnitude of the situation is extraordinary, though one of the things I've learned from this project is, the issue goes well beyond the African-American community. So I was really surprised at these lectures by the number of people who came up to me afterwards and said, I've never told anybody, but I have a family member in prison. And most of the people who said that were white. So that was really an eye-opener for me. And when you stop and think about it, it makes sense. So there are currently about 2.3 million people in prison, and there are another 5 million people on probation, okay? So that's like 7.3 million Americans right now directly under the surveillance and authority of the criminal justice system. So multiply 7 million by 4 or by 10 to figure out the number of other people they're connected to. So somewhere between 28 and 70 million Americans are currently directly affected by the experience of incarceration and probation.
Now, certainly race does play a role, but do you think it's socioeconomic? I mean, what is your sense at this point? Is it, you write about what you call the para-state, which is this structure that sort of governs life for a lot of people in low socioeconomic areas.
Right.
So do you think it's really, that's a real big determinant?
There's a lot to say there. So what I mean by the para-state is the fact that with our approach to drug control, the war on drugs, we have established this alternative social universe. So people don't realize that Americans spend, like every 3.5 days, Americans spend $1 billion on drugs. Right? Every 3.5 days. It's like $100 billion over the course of a year. And you have to understand that that's then $100 billion illegal market. So that's a huge amount of activity.
And there's a huge structure that supports it.
There's a huge structure that supports it and organizes it and maintains control over the distributors at the low level. And that's a sort of structure of violence and, you know, just all kinds of terrible behavior. And so, yes, I think young people, especially in urban situations and in conditions of poverty, get trapped in the fight between the para-state and the state, which is a very violent fight. I think it's important that, you know, one of the things we've all seen in recent years is the huge rise of the opioid epidemic. And it's really important to see the way in which the problem of drugs and addiction affects everybody, white, black, everybody. And so people are often taken aback to learn that the group that has seen the greatest rise in incarceration in the last decade is actually white women. So this is what I mean when I say this: the fact that you have a huge prison system ultimately comes to affect everybody.
And the prison system is actually plays a role within it itself because we have this huge structure.
That's right. Yes, absolutely.
And I mean, well, we can't get away from that.
Right. I mean, and the issue of for-profit prisons and the kind of incentives people have to extend incarceration. So I'm a big advocate of criminal justice reform, but I actually think that one plank of criminal justice reform needs to be re-empowering rural economies. So what are the other strategies for empowering rural economies other than building prisons and building out jobs in prisons?
Yeah. Well, let's take a step back to the story of your cousin, Michael. Tell us about Michael growing up. You became, you said, the person in care when he was released from prison in 2006, but were you close always growing up?
We were super close. So I'm from a huge extended family, and this will be familiar to a lot of people. So my dad had 11 brothers and sisters. He grew up in North Florida, and a subset of the siblings had moved to Southern California. And so that part of our family was just incredibly close. Family picnics and holidays and always playing together. Michael's mom, Karen, was my dad's youngest sister, and they were super close. So they're really just like a really close pair of siblings. So I, my brother, and then Karen's three kids in that order, because we were all 18 months apart, like, you know, porch steps, basically.
Right.
We just really spent a lot of time together running around in the streets, playing football, climbing trees, baseball, whatever, riding our bikes. So it's just that kind of joyful child's existence in Southern California. And at any rate, so yes, our tracks diverged at about the point I went to college. Michael's mother remarried. And as it turned out, she married somebody, sadly, who was violent. And that really sort of took things in a very different direction for Michael and his siblings and his mom.
One of the reasons I brought up the idea of socioeconomics playing a role, because there was a time when your aunt was living in Claremont, where your father
right,
was
college
a college
town.
Where he was a teacher. And there was a very different, you know, he was getting in trouble with the criminal justice system, you know, typical juvenile offenses when he was in Claremont. And yet you contrast that criminal justice system with the inner city of Los Angeles County.
Right.
Two completely different criminal justice systems.
Well, yes. I mean, I think this is the thing. One of the things that I had to come to understand looking back was because when Michael was arrested when he was 15 in South Central Los Angeles for this attempted carjacking, it just took us all completely by surprise. He had never done anything like that. That is, it involved a gun. It was, you know, hugely violent action. Luckily, the only person who was hurt was Michael because his victim wrestled away the gun and shot him through the neck. But we were just completely blindsided and confounded. And so the thing that I needed to understand was, so when, you know, a year and a half earlier in Claremont, he had shoplifted on one occasion, and he had stolen a radio from a neighbor's house when his mom was housing for that neighbor, and his mom had taken him to the police for that, right? But that was the sort of the level of trouble that we understood him to be in danger of. And so there was this like exponential increase in bad behavior. And that was, you know, took us completely by surprise. And so working on the book, I came to understand that his mother had moved, their apartment building had burned down in Claremont, and his mother, to get closer to her job, had moved them back to Los Angeles, and they had landed in South Central at a very dangerous time where the area was riven by gang conflict, and Michael had been sucked into that, which none of us had seen. And so the sort of devastating part of the story for me is really how adults and sort of older people don't see what's happening with young people. So one of my kind of big messages is people really have to talk to each other. Like, they really have to share what they see. Because when I went back and tried to piece it together, I discovered that this person had this tiny little piece of information and that person had that tiny piece of information. And nobody had shared them. And if they had, we would have been able to put the picture together at the time that Michael was being, you know, attracted to, pulled into gang experiences.
Yeah, it seems like this is a story of a lot of bad decisions on Michael's parts, but it's also a situation where the decisions that were to be made, there weren't a lot of good options in LA at that particular time. And just the sense of the way he was picked up in this crime, he was not a thug holding a gun to a person's head. He was holding the gun at the side. He says, "I'm taking the car." The guy says, "No, you're not." And he grabs the gun and shoots him.
That's right, yeah.
And immediately confesses to other crimes. It's almost like he wanted off the streets.
Well, he did want off the streets. And when his mother wanted to bail him out, he said he told her not to. He didn't want to be back on the streets. So I think the question of what kind of decisions Michael was making is very complicated. He did make bad decisions. There's no question about that. But in working on the book, I did a lot of reading in the sociology of how it is that young people come to be involved in gangs. And the basic lesson is that young people, in context of great violence, need protection. And the first people who offer them protection are usually gang members. So they accept that protection. Is that a bad decision? Yes, it's a bad decision, but there's a rational reason for making it. There's an incentive for accepting that protection.
And if you refuse that protection, you're in danger. You're in danger.
You're more vulnerable. Exactly. And so that's where it gets really complicated. And then the trouble is, once the young person has made that first decision, has accepted that protection from the gang, then it's very hard for them to extract themselves from that. And the usual pattern is a kid starts flirting with gangs and 18 months later they have their first arrest. And that is exactly the pattern that Michael had.
Yeah. Of course, when Michael was arrested and immediately confessed to not only this carjacking, but several other armed robberies.
In the same week, yeah. Netting $22.
$22. Yeah. This came at a horrible time because at this point you're looking at three strikes and you're out in California that had just been implemented within the year.
Right.
And, you know, even though he was still a juvenile,
yep,
it applied to him. It could, they were making a case that it could have applied to him.
Yes, that's right. So Michael in 1 week had a crime spree. There's no question about that. So when he was in the ambulance after getting shot in his attempted carjacking, he confessed to having robbed four people that week at gunpoint. So that came out of the blue. We had never seen him do anything violent.
I guess the police had never even knew that he'd actually committed these crimes because nobody had reported them.
That's right. Exactly. Yes. It was a week's crime spree that came out of nowhere. As I worked on the project, it became clear that this was the moment that his relationship to the gang was crystallizing. So that's the sense in which it was a young person who, like, this is the moment he took the really wrong turn, right? That's the moment. The question is, what do you do with that kind of moment, basically?
My guest today is Danielle Allen. She is a Conant University professor at Harvard and director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. Her latest book is titled Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. It's published by LiveWrite, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, those decisions continued through incarceration, and of course, when he finally gets out in, 2006, about a decade later, you're the caregiver in a way to try to get him back on the right road. What was that experience like?
So I was the cousin on duty, as I call it. I mean, I have to say his decisions in prison were good. Mm-hmm. He never got another, you know, people call it catch a charge. He never caught another charge in 11 mm-hmm. years in prison. That's a pretty impressive record. He was admitted as a violent offender because of the nature of his crime. He was downgraded. And as a consequence, he was able to fight fires in the, you know, California. California uses incarcerated people to build out their wildfire fighting force. And so he did that for several years and he was excellent at it. He loved it.
Did he find that was going to be his calling?
He loved it. Absolutely. I mean, it was a thing that he wanted to do. And, you know, our hope when he was released was that he would be able to go to a place where he could be a part of a fire camp. But at that time in California, you had to be paroled to the place where you had committed your crime, which meant sending him straight back to South Central Los Angeles. So he had also done college courses while he was incarcerated, which was hard to do because in the 90s, in addition to the three strikes you're out law and the lowering of the age at which juveniles could be tried for adult crimes to 14, that happened just a few months before Michael was arrested. In addition to those kinds of things, California had stripped education out of the prison system, and the federal government had removed Pell Grants for supporting incarcerated people. So we managed to get correspondence courses from Indiana University for him, which he loved. So the combination of wildfire fighting and college courses was great. So when he got out in June 2006, we had high hopes for his prospects.
But of course, he's going right back into the same place in which, you know, this was back into the fire, really, instead of being a firefighter.
Yeah, and he was going back into the same place. Though, in all honesty, I think the absolutely hardest thing is something that we don't talk a lot about, which is think of yourself at 15, right? Just think, you know, remember back to that age, all the trials and tribulations of adolescence, the secrets you held from your parents, the kind of coming to know who you are as a person, as an adult, as a person with romantic feelings, etc. 15 to 26 you spend in a prison. Michael fell in love while he was in prison. And the relationship with his girlfriend, a transgender woman he fell in love with in prison, was at the end of the day unbreakable for him. He couldn't walk away from it. And so ultimately it was a struggle he had over the 6 to 9 months when he first got out about whether or not to reconnect with the person who was the love of his life. And he did end up reconnecting with her. And she was much more closely connected to worlds of violence. And that put Michael back in prison and ultimately led to his death. Yeah. But the point I wanted to make there is when somebody has been inside a prison for 11 years and has had to survive it, one of the ways you survive it is by finding relationships that sustain you. So how do you walk away from those? But you have to if you're going to change your life. And I think that we don't squarely and honestly recognize the psychological challenge of that.
And that's a key part of any parole agreement is you turn away from all your support networks, basically, that led you to trouble in the first place.
That's
because
right.
If they're involved with the criminal justice system, you can't have any contact with them.
That's right. As I was working on this book, one of the most painful things I discovered was the contrast between our own sanctioning system and sanctioning systems in places like Germany and the Netherlands. So, for example, in the United States, out of all the sanctions that our criminal justice system applies, 70% are incarceration. In Germany, 6% of the sanctions are incarceration. In the Netherlands, it's 10%. And the reason for this is because they recognize that removal of people from positive society does damage to them and then also to society. And so they've built a whole array of tools for sanctioning people that simultaneously also work on improving their positive social relationships.
Yeah, you're gathering, you're basically assembling all these negative behaviors together
right.
to form basically a support network.
That's right, exactly.
Whether it's found in prison or, you know.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Of course, I wanted to ask you a question. If Michael had been able to go to a fire camp to serve his probation on parole, do you think things would have turned out differently? Or do you think that connection that he had with Bree, the transgendered prisoner that he fell in love with, was too strong?
I think that's a great question and an unanswerable question.
Sure.
So I think he would have had a better chance because he would have been doing a thing he loved. So he would have had one love set against another love. But also, I think a deeper problem is, you know, we, his family members who wanted to help him when he got out, you know, our list of things to do was get in school, got him enrolled in community college, get a job. He had a job at Sears within about a month of his release, for which I will be forever grateful. Get him a place to live and have all these things work in relationship to each other. So like, that was our checklist. These were the things that we knew how to do and we did them. And it never occurred to us, and I'm embarrassed to say this, to talk out loud with him, think out loud with him about a network of social relationships and about what it means to leave a set of people you've been really close to behind. In other words, he needed to grieve. There needed to be a grieving process, right? I mean, that transition is one that we think about in a whole lot of other contexts, but not when people are getting out of prison. We're so oriented towards the joy of liberation that we forget that that joy comes with actually a really meaningful packet of grief.
What is that grief? I mean, can you help explain it? Because there may be a lot of people. I'm sort of getting my head around it. I sort of understand it, but I don't understand it.
Well, it's the same grief as when people die, right? I mean, again, everybody, there's no question but that prison is hard. It's degrading. It's violent. You lack basic forms of human care and sustenance. People have to live in ways that none of us want to live inside prisons. Yet they survive anyway. How do they survive? Because they do build networks of support that sustain them and provide resilience. Lots of times religion helps. Now that's a very positive version of the kind of support that you can find in prison. But people also just form all kinds of other relationships. And, you know, just as with any family, if you had to, you know, had to go someplace knowing that you could never see your family again, you would have to grieve. That would be a hard thing. That's what I'm trying to describe.
Yeah. Well, if I can challenge you a little bit, I mean, yes, prison is a place where there's no care, there's no sustenance, but there is, you know, there are meals that are fed every day.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, there is, if you're involved, if some another inmate is beating you up, eventually somebody will stop it. And yes, it's warped. It's warped.
That's granted, an open question, I guess. Yeah. I'll put on that one.
But when you're released, and especially if you don't have a support network, you're in a system of no care. No sustenance. You're just out there. You know, you talked about the checklist of school, job, place to live. If you have no support network, will you get a job? Will you get a place to live?
Sure. It's a long list of things involved in reentry. And all I'm trying to say is I think there are a lot of non-obvious things that go on that checklist. So my family, my extended family, was able to provide Michael with a lot of the kinds of support that people say people need for reentry. Right?
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, it wasn't enough. Exactly.
A lot more.
That's right. Yeah. And it's not just that it's a lot more. It's stuff that we actually are not good at thinking about because we don't look squarely enough at what being incarcerated means at a psychological level for a human being.
Yeah. Now, you've spent a lot of time with this subject. I think your dissertation was looking back at ancient Athens,
right,
saying,
yes.
what did they do with the people who didn't follow the rules of you know, ancient Athens? And you wrote your dissertation on this.
Yeah.
You know, what are the best models for, you know, disciplining offenders of a society?
So I think there are two issues. I mean, the first is you have to pay attention to how many things you've criminalized. Point one. And then point two, the question is, okay, once you have a reasonable degree of criminalization, then how do you sanction people? So the relevant comparisons are Germany, the Netherlands, and Portugal, all of which have different and much more productive systems, lower recidivism rates, et cetera. And first, on the issue of criminalization, I do think that we have overcriminalized with our approach to drug control. So I am an advocate of legalizing marijuana and decriminalizing harder drugs. To say decriminalizing means that harder drugs are still illegal to use and possess, but they produce a misdemeanor, not a felony. And if you sort of get caught up with on account of them, you go directly to health services, not into the criminal justice system. And then criminal justice resources are redirected towards targeting the high-level traffickers. So to talk about or advocate a combination of legalization and decriminalization is not to give up on drug control. It's rather to think about the socially positive ways of controlling drug use. So, for example, in Portugal, which has this kind of structure and has had it for about a decade, they've seen reduced rates of adolescent drug use and actually more participation in medical services, health services around addiction, as well as seeing greater capture of high-level contraband, so just greater quantities. So that's, I guess, kind of a first layer. And in both Germany and the Netherlands, they do criminalize less with regard to drugs than we do. So that brings down the amount of sanctioning they're doing in the first place.
That would utterly transform our criminal justice system.
It would.
From federal all the way down to state
and
local.
Huge. It's huge. And even just to, you know, another little detail, I think the last year I looked specifically at this data, I think it was 20, 2013, something like 30% of new filings in federal courts were nonviolent drug offenses. So just think about a prosecutor's workload, too. If you could get rid of 30% of those new filings, then prosecutors could actually direct their energies to the really bad stuff that's going on out there, and we could be more effective in relationship to it.
My guest today is Danielle Allen. She is the Conant University professor at Harvard and the director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. And her latest book is titled Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. It's published by LiveRight. In our last couple of minutes, you do a lot of other, you've written this book, and obviously the reaction has been pretty strong. You mentioned the lectures. What was the reaction to the lectures?
Oh, gosh. People were just so generous. I mean, you know, it was embarrassing to stand up there weeping for 3 evenings.
That's not something you do in your classroom, usually.
No, I've never done anything like that. And they were just so generous. And, you know, just a lot of people came up afterwards and gave me hugs. And as I said, a lot of people started telling their stories. And that has been a big part of this experience. I have been traveling a bit, talking about my cousin and his story. And wherever I go, I find lots of people have stories. Yeah. So I've come to think of myself as a kind of butterfly net or something like that, where, you know, partly what my job is to catch all the other stories that are out there. Because again, like if you think about it, and I said at the start of this conversation that as many as 70 million people in the country are you know, directly affected right now as we speak by the experience of incarceration. Do we hear 70 million stories?
No.
Exactly. But I can tell you from going around talking to people that they're out there and they're just all trapped under a kind of, you know, a dome of shame. And I do think we have to break through that so we can share the stories and get to a much more clear-eyed place for thinking about how to improve our society.
You know, your own, the cousin in charge, you know, in this situation, you were probably devoting an awful lot of time. You're living your own life.
Right.
I mean, it's one of these sort of life things that that people are forced to go through. And it's can be overwhelming for the you know, the relative in charge trying to help this person reenter.
That's right.
It really has a profound effect on a lot of lives.
That's right.
For every person we incarcerate.
When my book came out, I served as Dean of Humanities at the University of Chicago in the mid-2000s. And I had a friend from that, so a very generous philanthropist who had supported our work. And so she would come to events at the university and she would periodically invite me to do things. And I always had to say no. And when the book came out, she said, I always wondered why you wouldn't accept my invitations. And now I see it's just that you didn't have time because you were spending half of your time flying to California trying to help your cousin. And that's exactly right. And I had never told anybody. So I never told any of my professional colleagues that I had a cousin in prison. I was devoting a huge amount of my time to trying to help him. And yes, but at the same time, I was covering it up. I was hiding it. So the book is a kind of coming out book, too, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, Danielle, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you
very much
for
having me.
Us.
I really appreciate it.
Danielle Allen is the Conant University professor at Harvard and director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. Her new book is titled Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. It's published by LiveRight. She'll have a book signing and talk tonight at 7 o'clock at the TCC Center for Creativity, sponsored by the OK Policy Institute and BookSmart Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.